This episode is brought to you by 2020, where creatives go to get inspiring and authentic stock photos. If you're tired of scrolling through uninspiring, staged images, check out 2020. Their images are crowdsourced from real-world photographers, and you can choose from millions of high-quality photos available under a simple, royalty-free license. Today, 2020 is offering TGD podcast listeners a free trial of 5 photos so you can see for yourself. To start your trial, go to 2020.com/TGD. That's the word 20, then 20.com/TGD to get your first 5 photos free. Thank you, 2020. This is the Great Discontent Podcast. This conversation was recorded in front of a studio audience at the Wythe Hotel in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, as part of TGD Live, a monthly interview event series. Your lovely and well-dressed host for the night was Tina S. Maker. Enjoy the show.
So our first guest has created illustrations and pattern designs for newspapers, magazines, wallpaper, bedding, books, billboards, and subway posters. She has authored and illustrated 9 books, including Hello, New York, an homage to her hometown, which was praised by the New York Times. She co-founded Women Who Draw, a directory created to increase the visibility of female illustrators, with an emphasis on female artists of color, LGBTQ, and other marginalized groups. She lives and works from her studio in Brooklyn, New York. Please welcome Julia Rothman. Welcome. Are you ready for this?
No.
I think you are, yeah. Well, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Super stoked to have you here. I want to start from the beginning of your story, which happens to be in New York. You were born and raised here in a
place nobody's ever heard of, yes, called City Island.
That's right, in the Bronx.
Yes.
Has anyone here heard of City Island? Yeah. Good work, guys.
If you're my friend, you're not allowed to raise your hand. It's 1.5 miles long, 1/2 mile wide. It's called the Seaport of the Bronx. Yeah,
I did not know all those facts.
There's just like one long avenue, and then there's little blocks off of it. And then at the end of every block, there's a beach. So we had a beach. But I don't know, you can swim in it, but you know.
But you probably
don't
want
to. But there are needles
to.
And, you know. No, we did swim.
Okay, you were adventurous.
It was fun, yeah.
So, other than the beach and the needles and the beach.
No, there weren't really needles.
This is going to be a really good show,
sad.
You guys. We are just out of control already.
No.
Tell me about what it was like growing up here and how your childhood influenced your ideas about creativity and what was possible.
Wow. Well, it's this small island. Everybody knows each other. So it was like living in a small town. But then in high school, it was like sneaking out, changing in the car, going to dance clubs, like the Limelight and the Tunnel in New York City. So on the weekends, you'd go to Manhattan, but otherwise you were on the island. So this is weird juxtaposition of small town and crazy New York life. And how it influenced my whole entire life. I think, you know, being around so much culture and so many things and so much busyness and so much clutter, I think maybe that had some sort of effect on what I draw and what I like to draw.
Did anyone in your family work in the creative industry, or did they do more traditional jobs?
Both my parents were teachers. My dad was a science teacher and my mom was a kindergarten teacher. And my dad kind of, I guess maybe he wanted to be a scientist, and now my sister is a scientist, and my mom wanted to be an artist, and now I'm an artist. So it's kind of like we're living out some of their dreams in some way. My mom wanted to be an artist, but her parents said she should be more reliable job and make sure she can make money, so she became a teacher.
Which makes so much money.
But now she, well, yeah, you get a pension, and
I mean,
I think
you
they
have,
had
you get
great
health insurance.
Careers.
Yeah, it's more, I guess, more stable. There's more of a,
I mean, than an artist's life. Yes.
Yes. Agreed.
Sure. But now my mom makes art and is taking photos and doing all the things that she wanted to do. So I'm really happy for her.
That's amazing. I love that. And so what forms of creativity were part of your childhood? Like, were you drawing from a young age? Were you taking art classes in school? Like, how were you expressing yourself?
I was taking art classes. I was drawing. My mom was taking me to museums and exhibits. Yeah, all of those types of things. But I only applied to one art school. I thought I was not going to do that. And then when I got in, I was like, oh, I guess I'm going to do this because it's a good school.
Yeah, I want to talk about that. So we'll skip ahead a little bit because you did only apply to one art school because someone suggested that you apply. But the one art school you applied to was Rhode Island School of Design, and you just happened to get
Thank you, Matt.
You know.
My classmate.
So you applied to RISD, the only college you applied to. You got in, you went. At that point, had you considered doing illustration, or you're just like, eh, I'll apply. If I get in, maybe I'll be an artist.
Yeah, no, I applied, and when I got in, we went to visit it, and it was beautiful, and I looked around, and I looked at all the people, and I was like, oh, I fit in here. And then I looked through the catalog that they sent out to all the prospective students, and I said, this looks like the things that I do, and it was illustrations, so I said, I guess I'm gonna do that. And then I went into that department, and then I focused on doing that, and then I graduated and did that. It's really weird because people just don't usually stay in their major or do the thing they did in school, but I was one of the few people who was like, I do illustration, and now I get out of school and I'm doing illustration.
And what do you think you took away from your time at RISD? Like, were there any insights that you had about yourself or anything you learned that was helpful to you as you started your career? Like, main takeaways, maybe?
We didn't get these questions beforehand.
We didn't. And there might have been some wine consumed before we got up here.
That's my secret.
Oh, I'm telling all your secrets. Sorry.
I think both the teachers and more so the students were the biggest influence and inspiration. Having people in my classes who had their own styles and were really successful at what they were doing, and me being a competitive person wanting to do as well as they were doing made that drive stronger. And I think that was what I got out of it. Just being around those kinds of people who want to work all the time.
And finding, like you said earlier, you were like, oh, I fit in here. Like finding people who were like you or had similar interests, like where you feel like you can thrive and be yourself and really explore.
Yeah. I mean, there was a guy who, we all went to a concert, and the whole time he stood there and just like drew in his sketchbook of all the things he was seeing. And I was like, what is he doing? Like during the concert, why doesn't he want to enjoy it? But then I was like, oh, this is something maybe I would do sometime, something else. But it felt like all these people who are like really obsessed with certain things. And I feel like I'm sort of like that a little bit. So yeah.
And so then, so after college, you were applying for a ton of jobs and didn't get any. Did you get some interviews?
What happened was during junior year of school, I did an internship at this magazine called City, which the people there are now Refinery 29, which is really funny. So there was this magazine called City, and I went there with like a 1 hour photos of my work that I'd taken pictures of, and just was like, here's my stack of photos. This is what I'm doing right now. What do you think about me coming here and interning? And they were like, sure, like we can't pay you, but you can come here every day and work for us. And I was like, great. And so every day during the summer of after junior year, I went to this upstairs of the Merck Bar to this little office where they were producing this magazine. And I learned how to use Illustrator, and they let me illustrate the back page of the magazine every issue. So when I went back to school after the summer was over, I was still doing that job. And so I'd go to the computer lab and do these illustrations. And then when I graduated, I had all this work to show. So I had all this published work. So then I went out and said, like, here's my portfolio. And then people wanted to hire me more because they saw that I was already published. And so like I went back and moved home, but then I started getting freelance jobs. So I never had a real job.
Okay. Yeah. That's
just
what
went
I was
straight
getting at.
Into freelancing. So I guess I did apply for some, but my dad was like, there's all these mistakes on your resume. And I was like, oh, so yeah.
And you were like, but I have these
photos
of
skeletons.
The work speaks for itself. So yeah, that's what I was getting at, I guess, is the that after college you ended up freelancing, and you're still freelancing, what, 12, 15 years later? So
graduated in 2002. Right? Yeah. I think it's our 15-year reunion this year.
Crazy. So how did you, I mean, to go right from college to freelancing, how did you build momentum for yourself?
I worked really hard. I sent out postcards. I took Craigslist jobs that were dumb. I asked my family members to hire me. You try really hard to get as many jobs as you possibly can.
Yeah. What were, like, how long do you think it took you to feel like, okay, I'm doing this? Like, I'm...
Like 10 years? Okay. I don't know. A long time. Well, what happened was I was doing another style when I first graduated. It was like vector illustrator style. And then I started doing patterns for Hasbro, the toy company, because I had a friend who had worked there from school. And then I was like, oh, if I can make patterns in vectors, I can try to make patterns in the style that I really like doing, which is hand drawing stuff. So I started doing that on my own and then showing that. And then that got really popular. And that took off because of Design Sponge, really. When she saw my work and posted on her site, I got all these emails from all these companies I wanted to work for, and then it just took off from there, I would say.
Awesome. That's awesome.
Social media and blogs. Future. That helped.
So I guess, like, looking back on your experience, what advice can you offer someone who's just starting out in their career? Maybe, like, they're fresh out of school or just, like, a few years in.
To show their work as much as humanly possible. Everybody's scared, like, oh, somebody's going to copy me, or I shouldn't show this, but, like, show it as much as possible to everyone and everywhere. That's the advice.
That's good advice. And I think there's a fear, though. People are afraid that they don't have a voice yet, or their work isn't good enough. So how do you get past, do you just ignore that and show the work anyway?
Yeah, I think you have confidence in a certain personality type, and it lets you say, I'm cool and I can show this. I don't know, like, it is hard. I teach at SVA, and all the students sort of ask that same question. I was like, you have to just show it. Even if you don't feel like it's your best thing, just show it. Because you'll make better stuff, and then you'll show that too, and you'll just keep showing it and keep showing it.
Yeah, and as you're showing it to the same people too, they can see the progression of your work over time.
Yeah.
So you and fellow illustrator Wendy McNaughton started, co-created Women Who Draw,
right,
which is an open directory of female illustrators. So tell me a little bit about Women Who Draw and what was the impetus behind that. Is there a story how that started?
So it all starts in the bathroom. No, I was looking through my stack of magazines that I have next to the toilet, and I was noticing that on a specific magazine that I really like and think is amazing, the covers, many of the covers were just done by men. And I went back and looked, let me look back in the archives and see how many were done by women. And out of 55 covers in 2015, only 4 were done by women. And so I called Wendy and was like, is this terrible? And she was like, yeah. And we're like, what do we do? So we decided, instead of calling them out and making a big scene out of it or going public, because this is happening all over the board, not just in that magazine or anywhere, that we would create this directory so that people would be able to hire women very easily and find them, and women of color and LGBT women and people who aren't being seen.
And you have, I think you currently have 2,700?
3,000 plus now.
So if you are someone who hires illustrators and you say you cannot find a female illustrator to hire, you need to go to Women Who Draw, because there are plenty of talented women out there. What kinds of, I know you got a lot of coverage when the site debuted.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people were talking about it on Twitter, and I think you got some press around it. But what kinds of stories have you seen come out of it? Like the women who are featured on the site, have they?
Yeah, well, the best stories are that people are getting hired from the site. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are using it. So the New York Times is using it, and I don't know, all these major publications. We're doing collaborations with big companies, which I can't tell you about yet, but and major institutions, and it's working. So it's really exciting, and it's very rewarding, because you have people emailing you and saying, like, I got a job from Women Who Draw, and thank you so much. And so it feels really good to be helping people. get work, who deserve it, who are very, very talented.
Yeah, there's so many. I've scrolled through just like, it's like endless.
It is endless. It gets a little bit overwhelming, like, but the site works so that every time you go back to it, it reloads in a different order. So anytime you go back to it, every day we changed it. So every day it's a different order. So if you go one day and you see all the people on the, you know, and you're scrolling for a long time, the next day you look, it'll be all different people.
And it's also, you can also search, there are search terms based on location,
nationality, orientation. So if you're going to do a story about Hanukkah in your newspaper and you want to make sure you hire a Jewish person who will know about it, this is a true story. Because I got hired and then I did the illustrator, knew nothing and did all the order of the candles wrong and drew everything wrong, even though I was Jewish. So you can hire somebody who knows about that topic.
And if someone is a female illustrator and they want to be included on the site, how does that happen?
Everybody is included. As long as you have a working website, you upload a woman on a white background and it's a full body woman, you'll be on there.
Awesome. So if there are any female illustrators in the audience or anyone listening at home and you want to be included on the site, you can go to, is it womenwhodraw.com?
Mm-hmm.
And check it out and submit your info.
Look, you've likely heard of MailChimp, and there's a good reason why. More than 15 million people use MailChimp to connect with their customers, market their products, and grow their e-commerce businesses every day. But here's something you might not know. You can run Facebook ad campaigns right from MailChimp. Use the same simple design tools they give you for email to create great-looking ads. You can target ads at your audience or people similar to them, which is a great way to reach new customers. Track sales, customers, and subscribers all in one unified dashboard for both advertising and email. If you're looking to up your email game or try your hand at a Facebook ad campaign, MailChimp has the tools you need to grow your company in a way that feels right for you. We want to thank them for supporting the Great Discontent podcast. MailChimp, send better email, sell more stuff.
Cool. Well, I'm going to bring up our second guest now, and I think it's going to get a little rowdy. He promised me not to be, but Okay, so our second guest is a UK-born New York City-based artist who is well-known for his doodle art style. He studied fine art at Nottingham Trent University and graduated in 2001, after which he began developing his now pervasive and instantly recognizable aesthetic that exists across a multitude of forms. He performs, speaks, and teaches internationally and has collaborated with well-known brands like Sony, Nike, Puma, Pepsi, Levi's, and MTV. Please give a warm welcome to John Bergerman.
Thanks.
All right. Thanks. That was quite an intro, John.
Oh,
there's a lot to say.
Well, you said it. That's
very
kind of you.
I rehearsed so many times. No. How did your childhood influence your ideas about creativity and what was possible?
Oh, I don't know. I grew up in England and I remember I wanted these felt pens that were like round balls with little nibs coming out, like for toddlers. And my parents refused to buy them for me. They said that I was too old and they wanted me to have like just normal felt pens. These came in like four colors and the felt pens came in like 100 colors. And I ended up with the felt pens. That really annoyed me. And and since that day, I thought, you shouldn't discriminate between what materials you use. You can make work with anything, round ball pens or little felt pens or anything. So I don't know. I was encouraged. My mum studied art a little bit, but then she met my dad. And then it all ended. And she went to St. Martin's College, made famous by the Pulp song. And but she wasn't in the Pulp song or anything. So she was a creative influence on me. And she would sometimes make like paintings and things. We had a spare room until my younger brother was born. And then that became a bedroom. So that was my first studio.
So that ruined things a little bit. Art, when your brother was born, your art studio went away.
Yeah, I'm a middle child. And when my younger brother was born, that was it. My studio was, and I used to share it with my mum, and we would do little drawings together like that.
That's awesome. So you were encouraged to do art,
but not as a profession, right?
You were actually told, like, you were actually discouraged from doing art as a profession because your family didn't think you could get a job making art.
No.
So what what made you, what gave you the conviction to pursue
just
it anyway?
To annoy them a little. And I don't know, because I can't do anything else. Like, it's that or nothing. So, and also my older brother is a solicitor. My younger brother is an economist. So I feel my parents did pretty well. You know, they got a pretty good roll of the dice there. So I'm allowed to do what I want. So
yeah. So you're the middle child, and you're an artist, and that's very.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So tell me. So when you were getting ready to go to university, as you call it over there, right?
Yes, that's right.
You decided to study fine art?
Fine art.
So tell me a little bit about the path through college and then the first years out of school.
All right. Well, in the UK, you do a year before you go to university called foundation. I don't know if it exists anymore. But so you do art at school, which is normally just like painting and like very traditional-y stuff. And then when you go to university, you might end up doing fashion or photography or sculpture. So in the UK, you do a year before that where you get to try everything. And you do like a term doing different things. And I started off. So you do that for a little while, and then after Christmas you specialize. And I specialized in graphic design, and I lasted about a week because like the projects were so boring. They were like design a toothpaste box or a light bulb box or something. And every time I'd walk to the graphic design studio, were all like little white tables like at an angle like that in a row. And then to go to the canteen, you have to walk past a fine art area. And like every time I walked past, it would just get a little glimpse of like paint being thrown and like people running around screaming and giggling and like, you know, just like crazy stuff. And you're like, well, I should be. And then what I tried to do is negotiate doing like 2 days a week design and, you know, 3 days a week, whatever, doing fine art. And they wouldn't let me. I was like, can I have my own pick and mix selection of the course? And they were like, no. So I just was like, all right, I'll do fine art. And that's how I ended up doing fine art, really.
Okay.
Just, yeah.
Yeah, and then you were like, those are my people. I've found them.
I need to go be with them. I mean, there are a lot of deadbeats that do fine art on foundation. Because, like, foundation is great, but also all the people that didn't get into university, they were like, oh, maybe we'll try art then. They end up going to foundation as well because it's the only place that will take them, which is totally fine, which is good. I'm not, you know, because they're like, you know, they're like not being pretentious about things. They're just like, and they approach it all with a good heart. I don't know. It was really weird, but I had a great time. I don't know if I've ever felt I've met my people. I don't think I have people. Mm. I'm just a person. You're a person, Julia. We're all people. And whilst we can be friends with each other, we'll always just be people. You know, we're all
we
alone.
Are all just people. We are
you
all
know,
alone
it,
in the end.
Ultimately, in the mm-hmm. end.
We are.
Anyway,
so
but...
After
But I did have a good time. I had an amazing time. And I went to university and I studied fine art in Nottingham, which was brilliant. Because every day I got up and I walked to the studio and you did whatever you wanted. And this was like a dream. So and you had some lectures and you did some trips, travel journeys. And and bought lots of records and, you know, went to parties. And it was amazing. And I was like, I knew even then that would be like, this is a great time to you know, be doing stuff because it was all so fun and open. And then, you know, 3 years go by very quickly, and then you're alone again. No, and then you're and then you're just out, you know.
Yeah,
and
then you're like, out in the real
you're
world.
You're out in the real world.
And so what was that like? I know your first big job was Levi's.
Oh, yeah. I had a job when I had that job. It was funny. I mean, I had a part-time
tell
job.
Tell me about that.
Well, I had a part-time job that I did when I was a student, and I carried on once I graduated. It was sort of art working, so not really a design job. That would be too grand a title for it. But it was, like, you know, I'd sort of lay out packaging design, and they'd be turned into bags and boxes for retailers, right? And I would have to burn a CD and send it to China. Eventually, we got an ISDN line, and it was sent. But sometimes I would make a typo, and like 13 weeks later, a giant boat would dock in England, and these giant pallets would come off the boat, and they would be like couriered up on giant trucks to the said retailer, and they would prise open one of the boxes, and there would be a typo, you know, their address would be spelt wrong, and that would be me. I'd have done that on, like, you know, 100,000 bags. So... They should have a copy editor. It's completely my fault. It is my fault, really. No. Anyway, it taught me. I mean, everyone blamed me, so. I think it
You're
was
like,
my fault.
You're like, I'm just the artist.
Literally copying and pasting stuff, and I screwed it up. So, but it taught me to have a real good attention to detail. Sort of thing, because like when you make and I did it a few times, and then it got like, you know, it's scary when that happens. Like the feeling you have, like rises up, you know, within you, is awful. When you can hear them on the phone in the other room, and they're arguing, and you're like, oh shit, and you like open up the Quark Express file, and you're like, oh no, and you. And it's already too late. And it's awful. It's an awful feeling.
So you were working that job with the typos, and you got a job for Levi's.
Right, yes. They rescued me. Levi's did rescue me. Because I was making work, and I wasn't showing it people, but I was like making it into stickers and putting it on things. Because you don't have to interact with people that way. And then I did that a bunch, and someone put me in a book about street art stickers. And then some art buyer at Levi's had bought this book and basically was just commissioning everyone in that book, which was amazing. And I painted a leverette patch. You know, like the brown patch on the back of your jeans? They made giant ones because it was the birthday of 501s. Anyway, it's not important, but I painted those. And then I had the phone call at work with the art buyer from BBH. And they were like, so we're going to pay you this much? I was like, what? And then we're going to want usage for this amount of time. I'm like, usage? Okay. And they were like, it's going to be a buyout. They want to own the artwork. So then they'll pay you this. And I was like, and it was like more than I was going to get paid for a year of my part-time job, basically. Because they asked me to do a bunch. And I'd never heard of any of these terms. And then I quit my job.
No more typos for you.
No.
Now it is your fault if you have a typo in your work.
Yeah, that's the beauty of a drawing. You know?
That's true.
There's no real typos in a drawing.
So yeah, we've talked about this Levi's job before, and you got paid a lot of money for that job, but you chose to more money than you had received at your other job.
I mean, it was like
But you chose to live very frugally and save that money, and as you told me, eat beans out of a tin can because you were living like a student still.
I like to
and
paint
saving
that
your money.
Yeah.
Yes, you painted that picture very clear.
I did buy a Nintendo GameCube as a treat.
Priorities.
Yeah. But.
And so you said that for the next year you got little jobs here and there, but having the money from the Levi's job was really, really saved you.
Yeah.
And you talk about this idea that, you know, it was a good lesson for you that money buys time because you saved that money. You weren't forced to go out and get another job.
I met like friends of like people who were also in that sticker book also got commissioned, and I met them at the launch of the sticker book, and they're like, everyone was like, money. It's like, are you in that book? Yeah, cha-ching. And like all these like street artists and sticker guys, they all had loads of cash. And then so I became friends with them, all different people from around the country, but a lot in London. And then like years later, it was like, why are you still working? And they're like, you know, they'd bought a TV and they'd gone on holiday and all this stuff. And then, you know, they still had to have a job. And I was like, I did live off that money for like over a year. And so it was good. Yeah.
That's incredible. That's a good lesson because you never, when you're freelancing, right? Work ebbs and flows, and
definitely.
And you don't know when the next.
I mean,
project
I never had that. Like, it was a good job. I hope that I would get like one job a year like that. That would be amazing. Mm-hmm. But not always. Like, you know, sometimes no jobs like that a year.
Yeah, and so you are very prolific, and you have some upcoming projects, some books coming out, like a lot of books coming out.
Yeah, stupid.
So don't tell me about all of them because there's
really
too many to cover
up
tonight.
But I just screwed up with success.
Yeah.
It went like, how many books? 100 books. No, but lots of books. No books for a long time. Like, and then like a bus. Three of them or
That's
four of
them. That's this fall, right? Tell me a little bit about.
So I just had a picture book. I made a picture book for children. Yeah. And that came out in the UK, and it comes out in America in June. It's called Splat. With an exclamation mark, splat.
I have a copy. You sent me one.
Oh, cool.
Or your publisher did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I told them to.
I'm sure you did.
It's as good as a gift. Did you read it? Did you look at it?
I didn't read it, if what? I'm going to be honest, but I have it and I will.
It's like 5 lines of text.
Okay, I didn't look at it yet. All right. I mean, it's in a pile with other things I have to look at.
All right.
I love you, John. I will look at it. I mean, we're all being honest up here, you know?
Yeah,
she's seen you naked.
Honest.
I didn't read your book.
It's not a trade. It's not a trade. It's not one or the other. Yeah, I see, you know, it's a... No, it's okay.
I made a picture book,
and then I've got another book coming out called The Daily Doodle, which is like how to draw stuff, right? Which is really funny. Like, learn how to draw something by someone that can't draw stuff. So it's a book of like animals and objects and spaceships and things, which is really fun. You can draw in the book, so that's kind of cool. And it comes with stickers and everything. So that comes out this summer as well. And then also with Chronicle, I've got a book called It's Great to Create. And that's coming out. And that is 101 amazing arty fun things you can do with your time if you want to.
Awesome.
Yeah. So that will be fun. And then I've got another picture book coming out in the autumn in the UK. See, it's too many.
Cool. Well, send me all of those.
No.
And I'll put them in...
You are off the list.
I'll put them in the pile with Splat. So I want to talk to both of you about a few things. I've interviewed a lot of people, and a lot of people confess to me, and I've done this as well, that they agree to do work or do something that they don't know how to do, and then they figure out how to do it and do it. And I think there's something helpful. You know, it's agreeing to do something you don't know how to do is scary, but, you know, sometimes it's necessary because it causes you to grow and learn in ways that you wouldn't otherwise. So, John, I know your secret. I know you lied in that job interview about being able to use Quark Express and a Mac, and then you went to the library and you were printing off how-to guides because this was a long time ago. Julia, I just met you, so I don't know if you've ever...
lied
about being able to do something to get a job. Have you done that?
Well, the first time I made a pattern, somebody said, "Can you make a pattern out of drawings?" And I said, "Yes." And then I just copied and pasted and made a pattern. But yeah, I didn't know what I was doing. So that was a big one, because then that like launched a whole thing.
Yeah, and now patterns are something you're known for. Mm. And you were like, "I don't know how to do this. I'm just going to say yes and figure it out."
Yeah.
So...
I think I'm still doing that. Like, somebody's like, "You're going to make an animated GIF for this project." And I was like, "Okay." And I don't know. I'll figure it out.
You'll yeah. Help me. I think it's an ongoing thing that happens,
right?
Because
they keep inventing new stuff.
Right.
There's all this new stuff. I asked like someone, a 360 video. How do you make a 360 video? Why do we keep going on with this stuff? There's new stuff all the time. Yeah, I can do it. You just put a camera on a ball and you... Is that how you do it? I don't know.
What I want to ask is, like, what have each of you learned, or how have you benefited from agreeing to do something that you didn't know how to do?
Go on.
Julia wants John to go first. John, why don't you go first?
All right. What was... I was hoping she
how
would
have
say
you,
something.
What? And then you could just kind of piggyback off of her. How have you benefited from agreeing to do something you didn't know how to do?
Oh, you get paid. I benefited financially by being slightly untruthful about my skill set. But, you know, everyone kind of does that a little bit. Mm-hmm. And, you know, unless you're doing surgery and stuff, that's not a good idea. But then you learn how to do stuff. I mean, like, if you say you can do something, and then you might, if you're studious and nerdy and stuff, you might go away and learn how to do it, which is important, you know, and that's how you learn how to do stuff.
And also, I would say you get to collaborate with people, and you get to benefit from other people's understanding of things.
Yeah, because you might ask a friend that can do that kind of stuff, and then they teach you.
And then vice versa, and we all share our knowledge.
As people. Together.
As just
together.
People. Only
together.
People.
Together people.
People.
Together, not alone. No, yeah. No, that's important. Because you freelance, you have a community of freelancers who you could reach out to and connect with if you are trying to do something that you don't know how to do, or you have a question even about something related to business, right?
Just like go having to a coffee shop. Yeah. Just shout it out.
Yeah, you could. Someone in
who's a video editor here? Like four people will put their hands up. You just ask them. They're waiting to be commissioned. It's all in the cafes, yeah.
It's true. Yeah. It's true. I did a co-working day the other week, and it was like, you know, at the coffee shop all day, everyone's just on their computer.
Yeah, you can get some good commissions in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that how you get your work?
Yeah, no. But maybe.
And Julia, how have you... Well, I guess you already answered that. So you mentioned earlier, you were talking about licensing and usage.
Oh, yeah. No, I did.
Yeah, with the Levi's job where were like, usage, what's that? Oh, yeah. Licensing, what's that? Yeah. Purchase the artwork, what's that? You pay me money for all those things as separate things. And I think like talking about licensing and usage doesn't seem like the most entertaining thing, but it's important because it means you get paid.
Yes.
And I think it's also, that's important. It's also about knowing your value and worth as an artist. And as a freelancer, when you're working in isolation and you don't have someone to tell you what your work is worth, it can be hard to know, especially when you're first starting out and you don't know what to ask for in the budget, or people offer you money, but the budget is low and you just take it because you want the work. So tell me, I guess you talked about your first experience with that job was the Levi's job. Julie, what was your first experience where someone commissioned you or talked to you about licensing and usage? And I think I read about it, that it was something to do with a pattern for a very low amount of money that you sold.
The first thing I did that... The big thing was that I went to Surtex, which is a design textile trade show where you go and you can either sell or license your designs. And at that point, I decided to sell them. And then I lost all the rights to them and the copyright and all this stuff. And then I learned about licensing kind of after the fact. And then I started licensing stuff and realizing, oh, I can keep the copyright and get paid for every single time it's used. And that kind of changed everything. But licensing has been like the best thing ever, because like a wallpaper I did 7 years ago that's so popular, I get a check for like every quarter of every year, and it's like something I don't have to touch, I don't have to think about it, just exists, and people still buy it, and then you just get checks, like the way books work.
How did you learn about that? Like, do either of you work with, do you have an agent that you work with that?
I'm anti-agent.
Okay, no, I'm curious. I didn't. I'm not sure. That's a whole. Maybe that's a whole other night. But I guess I'm just curious. Like, if someone's starting out, how do they? How do you figure out that information?
You do a trade show and you sell all your stuff and you realize you lose the rights, and then people make a ton of products out of it, and you're like, whoops.
Yeah, there's no way of not making mistakes, like doing anything, you know. And if you're starting out being an artist or whatever, you're going to make what you perceive to be mistakes. But like, if like, you know, you learn from them and it makes you sort of much wiser next time around, then it's okay.
Yeah. I think that's the best way.
I think that's the only... Like, I mean, you talk to your friends as well, your peers and stuff. I don't know if there's the society. Do they offer advice?
Sure.
Who is this?
Yeah, Society of Illustrators.
We're very involved in the Society of Illustrators. I'm the chair and he's my assistant.
Oh,
right,
you are?
Now.
For real?
But yeah, only just.
Yes, he will be the next chair after
just.
Me.
No, but I mean, I'm only just... I don't really know what I have to do.
Let's talk about this later.
But, you know...
We're the chair of the annual exhibition. But, yeah, it's a great place and supports illustrators, and I'm sure people there can advise.
You must get emails from people going, how do I do this? Or, like, can you tell what advice do you have?
But I have a thing on my website that explains it, so I kind of direct them there so I don't have to answer the question so many times.
Go to the web. Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. But, like, you know, occasionally you might, you know, help someone.
Sure.
There you go.
Instead of doing anything,
she helps people with the information she has on her website.
Oh, what Julia made with Women Who Draw is amazing. Mm-hmm. Like you guys, that's incredible. That's like, so there are things out there, like platforms and things for all different, like, you know, all different usage.
What she's saying, how do people learn about?
I know, but
licensing.
Like, just search. There's information out there. There's forums. There's people to chat to. There's groups. There's classes.
There's not enough about that, though. I would say
there's not like a one-stop place. I would say, but then you know,
But like for SVA now, I teach a surface design class, and that never existed before I started teaching it. And I teach all those kids about licensing now, which like they never knew anything about.
Yeah, I was just thinking there needs to be something for that. Something for people who aren't.
I pitched that idea.
I pitched that, and then I can be bothered.
They don't want business.
But, no, what? It's not. I don't know. It's a good idea.
You guys are telling so many secrets tonight. Okay, so I want to ask, like, what have you learned? Like, through the process of making mistakes, we learn about what not to do, what works, what doesn't. What have you learned about the value of your work throughout the course of your career? Because you've been doing this for a while. You've made mistakes and learned from them. And how does that apply in a practical way? Like, when you're negotiating with clients, for example.
Well, the big thing that I learned that is I'm okay. I'm not like that great an artist, but because I have the drive to kind of get myself out there and push, like I get a lot of jobs, but there's so many talented people out there who aren't willing to go and kind of say, look at me. And so then they don't get seen. And so I think that that's the most important thing. And then how that relates to clients, I don't know. What was the second part?
Well, I guess the second part is really just, have you learned any, like when you are negotiating fees with clients or just in general negotiation?
Never accept the first offer.
No, I usually write them and then they say, great. And then I'm like, damn it. So you try to get like them to say, let me go ask somebody about that. It's a little more than we want. And then they come back and say, okay, we can do it. That's like the ideal.
So always ask for more than what you think you're worth just to see if the budget's
there. People
have
given me that advice, like lots, like much more successful people. They always say, and always Americans as well. I think British people are a bit like, let's not talk about the money. And then like you get nothing. You're like, what the fuck? But like American friends of mine who are successful, they're like, John, always, you know, ask for more, ask for more. Cause they'll only say no. And if they say no, then, you know, maybe.
Then you just say, oh,
but then you go,
then
oh,
I'll do it for less. How much did you want
have to
it
wait.
For?
You have to wait a little bit. You go, I could maybe make that work.
Oh, I really want to work with you.
Actually,
yeah.
I got nothing else on and this would really help with the rent. No, don't say that. Don't say that. But yeah, ask for more. And like, because no one, like all these guys, they don't want to, no one's going to offer you the most of what they can offer. It doesn't make sense. It's all business, right?
So, yeah, it is all business. It is. So, and so you should ask for, I think it's Cindy Gallup. I don't know if you guys know who she is. She's an entrepreneur and the founder of Make Love Not Porn, which is a sex tech startup.
Oh, okay.
So we had her as a guest.
Oh,
and we can talk. We already talked about nakedness tonight. So this is just one step further. Anyway,
quite a few steps. That's a bottle of wine. It's maybe a cinema visit. It's you know, chocolates.
So Cindy is.
I don't get it.
Cindy is an entrepreneur, and she's really outspoken about women, you know, being paid what they're worth. And we know there's a wage gap between what men make and women make. And so I really like her advice, which is to ask for the highest salary or the highest fee possible that you can ask for without laughing. So, like, what's that highest number that you can ask for without, like, literally laughing because you're like, this is so high that it's absurd and I shouldn't be asking for it. I think you should go for it and see what happens. All and right. If it's not in the budget, then they'll say that, right? And then you can, like Julia made a good point, you can say, well, I'll do it at a lower rate this time, but I think it's important to let them know that's not
normal. Yeah, I mean, it's always a dance. It's a negotiation.
Yeah, it is a dance.
You know,
it is.
They probably don't expect you to say yes straight away.
It is a weird thing, like when a giant brand asks you, you know, you're going to do billboards and we're going to use it for this and that, what do you want to charge? And you're like, no idea. And so you just kind of count the illustrations and sort of say, for this many, I can do it for each. You know, itemize everything. That's how I would do it.
That's a good point. And then you talk to a friend who's done something similar and they say,
I
got this. And you're like, dang, I asked like
way
too little.
We're always texting each other like, this is the job. What would you charge? Me and friends.
Yeah.
Not you, but other ones.
Not John. You don't text John.
It's okay. Yeah, so, not ask people, yeah. It's
yeah,
good.
No,
not me.
People.
Don't ask me, but ask
people.
Other
are, people
just
are
people. Not one of
so I
want to
talk
people.
About people uh-huh. and community. And I'm going to quote you guys on some things you said on the internet.
I didn't know anyone was reading those.
Yeah. Actually, the thing I'm quoting you from is when I spoke to you.
Oh, okay.
But it is on the internet. Oh, so you guys have both... you both recognize the importance of people in your careers, and I think we focus on talent a lot, and talent is important. But as you mentioned, Julia, like you have to also work hard and put yourself out there. And then people are important; they play an important role in our trajectories. So, Julia, you've said make friends with everyone. Making a personal connection establishes a relationship that the client and I feel comfortable in, and then we want to work together again. And John, you said, another thing I've learned is that people are the conduit to everything. Nothing happens without people. No matter who you are, you need other people. You need to go talk to others, chat with them, laugh with them, have a drink with them. You need to be out there meeting people even more so now that our default is digital interaction. I think that's good.
Wise words.
It's
I
so
think
wise.
You'll agree.
So I want to ask, like, have either of you had a mentor or someone who was particularly important along your path? And John
you
is...
You don't have to say it,
John
Julia.
is coercing Julia to say him. But I'm guessing she's going to say someone
else. Other way, no?
I would love a mentor.
I mean, did you have anyone, though, in your life who was like a mentor to you?
No. What?
No?
Can you...
He
you
says no, and I say yes, many.
Really?
Yeah,
you
so many people.
Wow.
All the illustrators who are talented and amazing.
All the grown-ups?
Yes.
Have you had a mentor?
I have.
Well, how did you get one?
It was on accident. Actually, it was by accident.
Like Sesame Street or something.
No, but seriously, I would love a mentor. Someone to show me right from wrong.
So you don't have anybody you look up to? You're the top?
I look up to people, but how do you get them
who?
To help you? People.
Name one.
But how do you get them? When do they become your mentor? It's like that Seinfeld episode.
Okay, so I had someone tell me this. People don't become your mentor because you ask them to.
Oh.
They just become your mentor because you're around them and you learn from them. I mean, you could ask someone to meet with you, but
yeah.
In my case, my mentor was someone who I worked with, and so I was there and I could observe her and ask her questions. It was never a formal relationship.
No,
so I think there was no written agreement.
Right.
There was no...
Handshake?
Not even a handshake, no. So, Julia, have you had any mentors along the way who have influenced you? Since
I've
John
had
says
so
no,
so many friends who have helped me in so many ways, and I've looked up to yes, like a million. If I do, you want me to name people though?
You don't have to name people, but
yeah,
can you
sure.
say like tell me maybe how they influenced you or how they?
Well, I collaborate with two people in Chicago who know everything in the world, and they're very introverted, so nobody knows them, but they're the talentedest people in the ever, Matt Lamoth and Jenny Volbovsky. And one's a designer, one's an animator, and we went to school together, and basically they look at every single thing I make and give me feedback all the time and help me with any project I need. Plus, like, everybody in our field...
I think your definition of mentor is really, like, general.
You mean you want somebody...
You're just saying people that...
People
like,
that help me
but they're not mentoring
you. They're
not like, Julia, you need to cut your hair.
Yeah, they are doing that.
These shoes are not working for
they're
you.
They're literally doing that.
And let me introduce you to these people. Like, are
they
doing
are.
That?
Yeah.
But not everyone.
What about Anel?
Is she your mentor? Is she
a
my mentor?
Bit, yeah. Like, I want to be her when I grow up.
Oh. Well,
she's the
nice.
Woman who runs the Society of Illustrators. She's super amazing.
She is. But okay, that's good. But I would like him. A few years ago, I was like, I think I would really like a mentor to guide me because I didn't know what to do.
Who were the people that helped you or inspired you?
Well, being inspired by.
Okay, so who
you
are
be inspired
they?
By someone.
Can't think of
afar.
One person. Come on.
But, like, not they're not people that I know. They're like,
and that's the point. You don't have to know someone for them
loose.
To be a mentor.
Oh,
or
to
really? Be to inspire you.
So, like, Beyonce could be a mentor.
She could. Is there going to be dancing after this?
No. I don't know. Maybe. All right, okay. Maybe my definition of mentor is too stiff. Maybe I'm too...
Okay, let me ask you this. Have either of you had opportunities to mentor others or give back through... Well, Julia, you said you teach, and John, you do a lot of speaking. Mm-hmm. So what do each of you hope to contribute through those things to, you know, younger generations or the people that you're speaking to?
Shall I say? I don't know. Like, I just want them to not be as anxious as I was, and to have a good time and make stuff, and not be not so worried about everything. that's my main thing, I guess.
And Julia, what do you hope to give back?
Help to help them with the things I didn't know, I guess. Yeah, like licensing, for example. Like, I teach that, and then they don't make the mistakes I made. But also, I am very good friends with a few of my students. I also taught at RISD, and I have a few of those students who've just become my friends, and I actually learn from them too because they're young and have fresh brains, and it's nice to hear feedback from younger voices.
I'm mentoring my assistant.
Yeah.
That counts, right?
And she's mentoring you.
You do have a mentor.
Maybe. I would say I mentored Leah Gorin, and she mentored
me.
My
life is going to be misery. She bosses me around a lot.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, I think when you're working with students or mentoring someone, whether it's in a formal capacity or not, I think you do receive a lot out of it because they're asking so many questions, and it makes you think. You can't just keep things routine. You're like, oh, why do I do that? I don't know.
And they teach you, all people have another perspective on things, and that's really useful to see stuff through other people's eyes, all different types of people. And especially if they're younger and you do something and they're like, that's not very cool.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, okay.
I love that.
I think it's really good. I mean, that's important. We should all be sharing everything.
So I have one last question for you guys. And because you've been doing the work for a while, how long have you been doing this work, John?
Well, a little while.
A little while.
I graduated in 2001. 2001.
16 years.
It wasn't even the 20s. No. It was just the 2000s. Seems so long ago.
So, and you graduated in 2002, Julia, so...
Well, so not, we're about the same.
Yeah, about the same.
You're older.
I'm a little tiny smidgen older.
So I want to ask you, from the outside, from what you post on your Instagram stories, John, and, things you're posting online, it looks like, oh, they're having so much fun. It's glamorous. But there's a lot of hard work and discipline. Maybe. I don't know what you do every day, actually. But no, it's a lot of hard work. And you guys have been doing this year after year, working for yourself. How do you keep the work fun and interject play into your days? How do you keep things fresh? John, do you want to go first?
I think doing new projects, all different kinds of projects. I've just done totally different things throughout my career.
Yeah.
Illustration, patterns, making books. Then now I'm doing more journalistic things with a writer friend. And it just keeps changing what you're doing and how many ways can you expand illustration. So it's always exciting.
Yeah. The most important thing is to just keep changing. Growing, trying new things, experimenting, learning new stuff. Whether you're a painter or a drawer or digital, or mix it up, learn other software, learn other materials, go make, ceramics or woodwork. Just try any new stuff. And it's great if your work can help dictate that. If you get invited to do a project that takes you out of your comfort zone, that's brilliant. But just in general, the only way to do it, I just don't, some people just seem to do the same thing over and over and over and over and over. And that's great if you can do that. But I don't think I can handle being like that. So it's not even a choice. I have to just keep doing different things or I get very bored.
Yeah. And what you're saying is sometimes those things that you're exploring can be tied into commercial work that's mm-hmm. paid, and sometimes personal work that is unpaid, and it's something you do in addition.
That's why I'm so lucky. That's why, I don't know, we're so lucky. I'm so lucky is that sometimes I get commissioned to do stuff that I would want to do anyway. Do you want to design a level for a video game? Yeah, how much do I have to pay? We're going to pay you. Oh, wow, it's amazing. So, you know, sometimes, not all the time, but like stuff like that, it's incredible. Eh? You want to make an animation? Yeah, and I don't have to animate it.
The best thing you made was like the Trump things this year with the Cheetos.
Oh, no one asked me to do that.
I know, but it was like the, I think it was the best things you ever made.
The year's not out yet, though. Give me a chance.
What?
There's still a lot of the year left.
I know, but I'm saying that I think like when they're about things and they're about, your work is the best when it's like about something that's really important, but then you make fun of it.
Well, that's another important point, is to make stuff that you're actually emotionally invested in, not just, oh, I can draw pretty things, let me draw lots of pretty things. I mean, that's great to an extent, maybe, or like this style is great and everyone loves it, that's great, and if, but like I think after a while it just becomes stale and a bit boring, we need, you know, you need to refresh. And I think, yeah, you're right, when your heart is in something and you got something to say, you know, stories are the best sort of medium, whether they're pictorial, illustrations, or when you got stuff to tell someone, that, so when people are looking at it, they connect the dots and it makes a little circuit and they go, yes, I get it. That is the best. Mm-hmm. That's the best kind of work. You can't always, you know, like sometimes you're just noodling around. But yeah, have things to say. Believe in things. Stick to your guns.
That's
shine
good.
Your shoes. Comb your hair. Brush your teeth. Floss. I floss. Do you floss?
I do.
Yeah, it's important.
I use the sticks.
Oh, the sticks. It's still flossing. But yeah, you know, like, yeah, be about something. You know, that's what I would say. That's all the art and books and films and music that I like are, all have something about them they want to say.
That was good.
That was beautiful.
Thanks.
We're going to end on that.
All right, good.
Julia Rothman and John Bergerman, everyone.
This episode was produced by The Great Discontent and me, Benjamin Welch. The Great Discontent features in-depth conversations with today's artists, makers, and risk-takers. You can learn more at thegreatdiscontent.com. And of course, you can subscribe to this show on iTunes or wherever you find your podcasts. And if you enjoyed this episode, please consider giving us a rating in iTunes. It really does help spread the word. Thanks so much for listening.